Welcome to Ukraine Calling, where we try to find a little harmony hidden within the cacophony of news and views about Ukraine. I'm Marko Suprin for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the notes making headlines this week. Foreign policy is something that entails the work of diplomats, think tanks, policy wonks, and international institutions. And let's face it, we all work with ideas. Some professions take ideas and turn them into action, like doctors, engineers, scientists, researchers in labs, programmers, or code monkeys. Other professions work with ideas to get them accepted by institutions because doing so helps us understand ourselves, what we're doing, where we're going, and how we got here. Sometimes I think diplomats by design do everything to not call a spade a spade. A few weeks ago, when we were talking about fake news, Irina Chalupa was a guest on our show, and she said it best. Black is black. It's not mostly gray. News agencies have used the term the illegal annexation of Crimea when talking about what Russia did, which was invade and occupy. Well, the diplomats have finally stepped up, and now the United Nations adopted a resolution that recognizes Russia as the country that has temporarily occupied Ukrainian territory, the Crimean Peninsula. It also said that Russia needs to uphold its obligation under international law as an occupying power and end the human rights abuses against the residents of Crimea, release Ukrainians who have been illegally detained, and reinstate the Crimean Tatar Majlis, an executive body that represented the Crimean Tatars and is a member institution of the European Union's Platform of European Memory and Conscience. The Russian Civilian Occupation Administration in the Crimean Peninsula outlawed the Majlis in 2016, calling it extremist and a puppet organization of the U.S. Department of State. President Petro Poroshenko called the vote a victory for Ukrainian diplomacy at a meeting he had with the ambassadors of the G7 countries in Kyiv this week. He noted that the resolution that calls Russia the occupation power also recognized that Crimea and Sevastopol remain part of Ukrainian territory and defined the situation as a temporary occupation. He noted that it took the combined efforts of many states and their respective institutions to work on the resolution to finally get it adopted in spite of Russia's tough efforts to block the move. The president said, "It is important that we show and for the aggressor to understand that complying with international law, respecting the sovereignty and territorial integrity and independence of Ukraine is incumbent upon everyone, including Russia." 2 days after the UN resolution, the International Criminal Court in The Hague recognized the annexation of the Crimean Peninsula as a military conflict between Russia and Ukraine and a Russian occupation of Ukrainian territory. The prosecutors found Russia guilty of aggression and occupation, finally calling a spade a spade. Here's what they concluded. Quote, "The information available suggests that the situation within the territory of Crimea and Sevastopol amounts to an international armed conflict between Ukraine and the Russian Federation. This international armed conflict began at the latest on 26 February when the Russian Federation deployed members of its armed forces to gain control over parts of the Ukrainian territory without the consent of the Ukrainian government. The law of international armed conflict would continue to apply after 18 March 2014 to the extent that the situation within the territory of Crimea and Sevastopol factually amounts to an ongoing state of occupation. A determination of whether or not the initial intervention which led to the occupation is considered lawful or not is not required. For purposes of the Rome Statute, an armed conflict may be international in nature if one or more states partially or totally occupies the territory of another state, whether or not the occupation meets with armed resistance." We'll include a link to the full report on our site. In response, President Putin ordered the Russian Foreign Ministry to withdraw Russia's signature from the Rome Statute, the body that governs the court. Russia no longer recognizes the court's jurisdiction because one of the main things that the court looks at is war crimes and crimes of genocide. The United States has never accepted the court's jurisdiction, and now neither does Russia. Their decision will not change much in practice, The Guardian explained, but Russia's decision to withdraw from international jurisdiction is highly symbolic and should be of real concern when put in the context of the ongoing militarization of Crimea, the escalation of the armed conflict in eastern Ukraine, and strengthening of pro-Russian views in Europe. Now, Ukraine actually has never signed the Rome Statute, but has accepted the court's jurisdiction over alleged crimes committed on its territory from November 21, 2013 to February 22, 2014, as well as crimes committed after February 20, 2014. The court will also be considering if the ongoing conflict in Ukraine's Donbas can be designated as an international armed conflict with the Russian Federation. In other diplomatic news, Israel is preparing to recognize the Holodomor, the genocide of millions of Ukrainians by famine, organized by Stalin and executed by the then Soviet government as an act of genocide against Ukrainians. In a press release, the Israeli consulate in Ukraine said the Speaker of the Knesset confirmed that recognition is on the docket for Parliament. Israel's honorary consul, Oleg Vishnyakov, who proposed the move, said that, quote, Israeli Parliament understand the need to adopt this resolution and bring our people together. Israelis understand better than no one the tragedy that happened to Ukrainians, the artificial genocide that was initiated by Stalin's regime. President Poroshenko also had a telephone conversation with American President-elect Donald Trump. He welcomed Trump with his victory in the election and looked forward to actively working together and his administration to strengthen the strategic partnership between the United States and Ukraine. They agreed to appoint new people to work with Trump's transition team, and Poroshenko invited Trump to Ukraine as soon as is convenient for him. Meanwhile, the conflict in the Donbas is escalating. From November 11th to November 17th, three Ukrainian soldiers were killed and 14 more were wounded. Russian proxy forces launched intensive fire along the entire contact line. This week, they demolished over 10 houses in Marianka in the Donetsk Oblast and opened fire on a school. TSN reported that locals haven't experienced this kind of heavy fire throughout 2014 or even 2015. Russian proxy forces also used heavy weapons in Novobakhmutovka and damaged a local agricultural complex. This week, Russian proxy forces also opened fire on civilians in Popasna and Stanitsa Luhanska and increased their use of tanks in Krymske in the Luhansk Oblast. There was also contact in the village of Tonenke in the Donetsk Oblast, where one civilian was killed. Ukrainian military forces stopped another Russian reconnaissance drone in the Donetsk Oblast, and Ukraine Security Service, the SBU, found an unexploded ordnance, a smirch produced in Russia. The bomb fell in the yard of a house in the village of Berezove, near Marianka. The press center of Ukraine Security Service informed Uniyan that this type of weapon is only produced in Russia and can only be operated by Russian professional soldiers. According to Glasnost Gone, the Russian Federation supplies weapons and army reserves by train. The media outlet published satellite photos and videos showing Russian trains unloading over 100 units of heavy machinery in the town of Sukhodolsk, a Ukrainian town temporarily controlled by the Russian Occupation Administration. Glasnost Gone claims that Russia has been and continues to supply Russian proxy units through a passage in Marinovka. The press secretary of Ukraine's Ministry of Defense, Colonel Lysenko, noted that this week 14 tanks, 24 trucks with ammunition, and 6 more railway carriages with ammunition prohibited by the Minsk Agreement, including the heavy artillery Grad system, arrived in the Donbas from Russia. Unlike Russian occupation forces and their proxies, the Ukrainian side sticks to the Minsk Agreement, according to a post on the Facebook page of the press secretary of the United Center of Coordination and Control, Taras Gren. He said that the OSCE has mistakenly reported this week the use of heavy artillery from a Grad system by the Ukrainian side. Apparently, the international mission relied on video shot at night, and it's easy to confuse fire from a Grad system with rounds fired from the automatic turret atop a BMP-2, which is not prohibited by the Minsk Agreement. Overall, the situation in eastern Ukraine is very tense. According to Uniyan, Anatoly Dublik, the head of the National Security Department at Ukraine Security Service, the SBU, has warned that Russia plans to simultaneously destabilize the internal situation in Kyiv and escalate the conflict in the Donbas. President Poroshenko advisor Yuri Buryukov also posted on his Facebook page that Russia has been trying to destabilize the situation inside Ukrainian military forces during the last week. Destabilization, a phenomenon in and of itself, is the most powerful weapon in the Russian arsenal, and it's something we'll talk about later in the show. The Atlantic Council this week issued a report called The Kremlin's Trojan Horses that details the Kremlin's toolkit of influence in Europe and includes policy recommendations to resist Russia's efforts to influence, infiltrate, and inculcate. Several protests were being organized by Yulia Tymoshenko and the opposition bloc, the former Party of Regions, a week before the third anniversary of the Euromaidan. They're protesting a hike in tariffs and against the National Bank of Ukraine. A lot of people took out loans when the hryvnia exchange rate to the US dollar was around 8 to 1, and today it's above 25 to 1. Some people have said the protests are fake, and are being paid by Grey Cardinals to push people to demand early parliamentary elections that not too many people support. But the more you fan a flame, the hotter the fire gets. Given the escalation of the war in the Donbas and the open supply of heavy machinery, ammunition, and Russian regular troops to eastern Ukraine, together with Russia's public withdrawal from the Rome Statute, those two might seem like enough to be pause for concern. But Russia has also done a lot of work to convince European Union countries like Moldova and Bulgaria to adopt the Russian view on Ukraine. And as a result, these countries are starting to sway in their support for sanctions. Ukrainians get a sense that their country is being surrounded. The governments of the United States and the United Kingdom announced a new shared project supporting Ukraine's anti-corruption efforts in the domain of electronic procurements, open data, and other electronic services. This international project will invest $19 million in strengthening public trust in the government by promoting transparency and accountability. This development is particularly timely, taking into consideration the recent scandalous publication of electronic tax declarations by Ukraine's governmental and parliamentary representatives. Ukrainian news outlets are also taking the role of the Fifth Estate a little more seriously. An investigative program called Scheme by Radio Liberty and Ukraine's public service broadcaster UA Perche uncovered that one of President Poroshenko's companies owns a villa in Spain, valued at around $4 million, but this did not appear in the president's tax declaration. The transparency of the newly introduced electronic tax declaration is contrasted this week with muddy political games behind the scenes that have apparently caused another resignation. The head of the National Police, Khatia Dekanoidze, and the last of the Georgians, resigned this week. She quit shortly after Mikhail Saakashvili left his post as the head of the Odessa Regional State Administration because, she said, she finished what she set out to do. At the briefing dedicated to her resignation, Khatia said she wouldn't spread schoolyard gossip but felt obligated to address policymakers and demanded that they not interfere in the work of the National Police. Ukrainian politicians have an Orwellian gift for doublespeak. Coincidentally, the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language added a new word, post-truth, to their new edition this week. 3 years ago, Ukraine's movement toward integration with the European Union was dislodged when then-President Yanukovych decided not to sign the Free Trade Association with the EU. At that time, students took to the streets to protest what they saw as a move that would destroy their futures. Then in response, the Special Operations Units of the Interior Ministry were called up and resorted to abject violence to disperse the students. The next day, over 1 million people, parents of the same students, took to the streets to protest what was clear to them was nothing less than a return to the Soviet repressive tactics. Shortly thereafter, Putin forwarded a loan for $3 billion to Ukraine, and this was interpreted as a payoff for not signing the EU Association Agreement. Now, Ukrainians have lived with Russian interference in the development of their own domestic and foreign policy for a long time. When international media outlets started to parrot Russian propaganda, that was enough for one activist to do something about the situation. Alexandra worked in environmental research projects and in an NGO to promote environmental education. For example, back in 2009 through 2011, she worked at the Ukrainian Hydrometeorological Institute, where she completed research and published a paper called Climate and Treeline Dynamics in the Carpathian Mountains during the 20th Century. But during the protests, she decided to put her command of English to good use and tell the world the story of the protests because the international media were portraying events in Ukraine through a Russian prism, essentially promoting a Russian bias about Ukraine. She is now, and has been since then, the managing editor at EuromaidanPress.com, an English-language outlet about Ukraine. Alia, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Marco.
Tell us a little bit about how Euromaidan Press started. What was the impetus for you to change the course you were on in life and help with the protests?
Well, back in 2013 and winter of 2014, I realized that what's happening is most important for me. It was more important than any research, pursuing any interests in life. I realized that this is it. This is the chance to change Ukraine into a country that I always dreamed of living in. So I joined the protests and tried to find a better use for myself. First, I just made sandwiches, and then I realized that maybe I could do something more specialized. And since I knew English, I joined a call for translators at the press center at the headquarters of National Resistance. At that time, the group was called Euromaidan PR, standing for Euromaidan Press Releases. And basically, we just translated a lot of what's happening on the ground and worked with international journalists coming to Ukraine in order to show them around. And from that time on, our group grew into basically a small-scale independent media outlet about Ukraine in English.
About how many people are working with you?
Well, we have some volunteers, maybe 4 or 5. Regular steady volunteers, and 3 regular staff.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I mean, they actually recognize that you guys are having an impact internationally.
Well, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs actually is very active in several directions. It's not in all countries it's successful, but generally they've been doing very good efforts, both in social media and in events on the ground. So they're actually... and very, very helpful. For example, in the campaign, Let My People Go, to free Ukrainian political prisoners.
That's right. You guys did a lot of work in
occupied Crimea and in Russia.
Do you follow those stories still to this day?
Yes, we're part of the Let My People Go campaign. So what we're doing is we launched a site in Ukrainian language about all the prisoners, and we're translating it into English right now. And basically, we're part of the information efforts to have these stories be known.
Do you interface with outfits like Amnesty International?
Yes, of course. The thing is that Amnesty does not take up all the cases of our prisoners because not all of them are political prisoners, but instead they are hostages of the Kremlin that are being used for mainly, as I see it, as for propaganda purposes, to create this image of a Ukrainian threat looming over Russia. And so Amnesty, of course, we have contacts with them and we have plans for joint events, but nevertheless... together with Euromaidan SOS and a number of human rights organizations, we tend to the fates of all the prisoners of the Kremlin, regardless of their views, political views, their activity. Some of them were just in the wrong place in the wrong time.
Like Sentsov.
Sentsov is a prisoner of conscience, and he's a political prisoner recognized by Amnesty and Memorial. But there are others like Litvinov, for instance, who was a farmer in the Donetsk region. He just ended up by accident in Russia. And after that, he was accused of massacres of the Donetsk Oblast, and shown on Russian state TV as this as Karatel, as this Ukrainian punisher, and from this image of a Ukrainian punisher, the comparison was made that all Ukrainians are punishers. And so, of course, this case is totally forged, and they had to apologize to him, actually, for this defamation that was issued on Russian TV. But nevertheless, he is sentenced to many years in jail in Russia. And
what are some of the efforts being underway to get his release?
Well, first of all... I mean, the only way to get them released is international pressure. I mean, we can't break into Russia, into the prison, and free him, right?
Right.
And so what are the methods of influence? It's to get international institutions, it's to get diplomats, politicians to pressure Russia and say that this is inadmissible, this violation of human rights is inadmissible.
It seems almost that the inspiration for your involvement was clearly Russian interference in Ukrainian affairs, and probably because... you can literally see the forest for the trees. You seem to have developed a unique talent, I think, that is to see Russian interference. I remember a story that Euromaidan broke about the origins for the calls for a third Maidan.
I can't say that we actually broke it because we see ourselves as an outlet connecting Ukrainian medias to the world. And there was this wonderful investigation by Texte Orgue about a group... about social groups and social media calling for a third Maidan. And basically, thanks to the work of wonderful Ukrainian investigative journalists, we were able to translate the story and get it to the English-speaking audience. And basically, it's the groups are linked to Stepan Mazura. He is a militant of the DNR, and who is now apparently in Moscow working on information operations to incite unrest in Ukraine. And the way, basically, I mean, how do we know that this is true? It's because very complicated work tracking the identity of the admins of the groups to Stepan Mazura, and basically his friends gave it away that it is him. So the groups involve many troll accounts, meaning that they're not real people. They're mm-hmm. artificially created accounts that at the time when a specific topic needs to be disseminated, I guess, against in Ukrainian society. They start publishing these things in groups, liking them, sharing them, and the friends of the bots, the real life friends, they also see this topic popping up in their feeds, and they start sharing it. And apparently, that's how you make a wave, basically, across social media. And then perhaps Ukrainian journalists will pick it up, and that's basically how you plant a seed of disinformation in the whole discourse. So basically, these groups are still operating in Ukraine. In my opinion, it's fortunate that the SBU is actually investigating administrators of such groups. Stepan Mazura is not the only one. Obviously, there were other administrators. And I've seen news of maybe a couple of arrests.
Is that connected? Do you see the response? I know there's a concept in Ukrainian journalism called djinse.
Mm-hmm.
Is that related? That's sort of paid journalism, right?
Yes, paid journalism. Actually, regarding djinse, there was a wonderful investigation released lately about how to track down djinse. It was a monitoring project by LigaNet. They investigated, I think, 10 leading internet sources for how often they produce news about ex-ministers of Ukraine. For instance, Medvedchuk or basically other ministers of the Yanukovych regime. And it turns out that you can basically spot the outlets that are getting money from them. And the amount of news from Medvedchuk is disproportionately larger, maybe like 10 times larger on UNN.com than on other outlets. So while the majority of outlets makes news about Medvedchuk only when it's worth making news about him, like his participation in the Minsk process or something. UNN cites him in any cites his opinion on anything, basically. And of course, this is also a channel for implanting Russian directed or Russian financed or Russian connected discourse.
That's incredible. So essentially, they have almost fake news outlets that would promote their positions in order to get a higher rating, thereby creating a out of nothing something.
Yes, out of nothing something. It's just to start. It's to influence public opinion, and but this is not even. It's not a problem of just separate outlets, though. This investigation focused on the 10 main outlets doing this. I mean, djinse is a problem for many, many Ukrainian outlets, and I mean, the chief reason for this is, of course, it's very hard to make money in Ukrainian media, and basically all of them need a sponsor to survive. So, these djinse, I mean, it plagues all of the Ukrainian media scene, and that makes it especially vulnerable for implanted messages that are a threat to national security.
I read yesterday that Victoria Sumar on her Facebook page is actually wanting to bring up the notion of djinse. She chairs the Committee on Freedom of Information and Press, I think.
I think that's a wonderful idea, actually. And it's, first of all, it's good to start talking about this. And it's good for the international media scene to know that this is a problem in Ukraine, and that it's not always a threat to freedom of speech to say that something, to censor some information in Ukraine. Today in Ukraine, sometimes it's a matter of national security.
Well, it's also, I mean, the notion of you can't really walk into a crowded theater and yell fire, right? This is part of the problem that sometimes in Ukraine, people are allowed to walk into a crowded theater and yell fire where there's no fire.
Mm-hmm.
A few days ago, Yulia Tymoshenko called for a protest without end, quote unquote. And according to the Kyiv police, about 6,000 people were at various places around the city center. Hromadske UA actually had a live stream, and the crowds, to me, looked a little thin. Do you see this as an example of Russian control or the so-called Russian plan to destabilize Ukraine?
Well, I wouldn't like to speculate on this. As I have no proof of this, I can't really say that, yes, this is Russian influence. But of course, the nature of the protests looked a little suspicious. Like, there were too many flags to the ratio of protesters. It looked all a little too planned. And I mean, this is always a red light that this protest is not genuine, but it's orchestrated by somebody and for some reason. We don't yet know who that person is. But this is one of the ways that Russia does influence politics in Ukraine. And basically, the latest leaks and hacks into the Kremlin's top officials, they reveal how they do this.
And right. Ukraine Calling tries to cover the negotiations in Europe. Almost every week we cover the development of Ukraine's path to Europe, be it the visa-free regime or the Normandy talks. And a few weeks ago, we actually noted that Vladislav Surkov was at the table next to Putin during the last round of negotiations. You'll remember that. Our listeners will also remember that we noted back then that Surkov is on a sanctions list and is supposed to be denied entry into the EU. Yet there he was. Shortly thereafter, news appeared that his email was hacked. Now, you've spent a lot of time going through the Surkov leaks. What have you found out so far?
What have I found out? Well, my first impression is that most of the journalists covering the Surkov leaks were a little bit disappointed. There was no smoking gun that would say, yes, Moscow is financing the separate, is behind the war in Ukraine. Indeed, that smoking gun was not there. There were no directions for Russian troops to go, no military instructions for Russian troops to get involved in the war in Donbass. But instead, what is revealed and what to me is even more damning is a picture of the longtime efforts of Russia to control Ukraine, to control the Ukrainian political scene, control the Ukrainian media scene, control Ukrainian public opinion, basically do everything that made Ukraine a satellite of Russia up until Euromaidan. And this picture for me, it's basically like a manual how to conduct a hybrid war in Ukraine. With war and unmarked troops, it's pretty clear. Oh, there's a military interference. But here, it's just long-time efforts to infiltrate and subvert. And I think this is actually hard to understand for countries that have never been under influence of the communist regime and under communist influence in Eastern Europe. And basically, what I've seen in the Surkov leaks is just very, very many manifestations of the soft power that Kremlin uses to control Ukraine.
For example?
For example, how to reach the Ukrainian soul. Prior to the famous moment when Yanukovych declined to sign the EU association agreement, a month before that, Surkov actually got an email where his political advisor advised him to stop supporting Yanukovych, that he was into Euro integration and it was not good for Russia to make his bets on him in order to advance the Russian policy in Ukraine. And Surkov got also like suggestions how to promote the Russian narrative in Ukraine, and it had many suggestions like we shouldn't, the Ukrainians are a proud nation and they should always have the impression that they're also in control. And there were advice also there, like before the US Ukraine association agreement signing in 2013, public opinion was heavily in favor of the EU. So Surkov's analysts take a look at why this is happening and they reach the conclusion that, of course, it's the journalists going to study trips financed by the EU. It's the students going on exchange programs. We should do the same. The later that we get into 2016, 2015, the more there is of these narratives concern discontent with Ukrainian politicians. So basically, it was in the Kremlin's strategic interest to generate unrest in Ukraine, to generate discontent with politicians. And I mean, Third Maidan, many politologists have commented that it is a strategic aim of the Kremlin to make everything just fall apart. But apart from these messages and narratives, how were they actually used, right? So we have these narratives. How do we get them into the Ukrainian media scene? Well, the Kremlin had a number of plans for this. To influence existing Ukrainian media. Okay, so in 2014, a letter, Surgov got a letter where he was suggested to basically take over a Ukrainian media holding, which is one of the largest players on Ukraine's internet outlet, and not only internet market, but also on printed media market, belonging to Sergei Kurchenko, which is a Ukrainian oligarch that is in exile in Russia right now. He was one of the main figures dealing with Yanukovych's financial situation. And Surkov is just bluntly suggested to take over UMH because Kurchenko and all of these other fugitive oligarchs were searching for supervision and basically offering their services. And so we don't know how this ended up, but today Korrespondent, which is the flagman outlet of Ukrainian media holding, it's one of the leaders in Jinsa, pro-Medvedchuk Jinsa and pro-other ex-minister Jinsa. So this is one of the way to infiltrate a whole media holding. It's possible that this happens. Then there was a plan to create new outlets and complete with the prices to create a new outlet. So basically, it's basically a question of how much the Kremlin is able to pay. For instance, a news site. A Russian propaganda news site from scratch would cost a little bit over $5 million. To create this news site, to spreading pro-Russian messages and promote it to being the top five in Ukraine. And then, so the other prices for getting a Russian propaganda site created from scratch into the top 20 is a little bit under $3 million, and top 75 sites is over $600,000. So basically, it's just an outline of plans how to create this platform to spread pro-Russian messages on a constant basis. So one very curious email caught my attention. It's called The Political Network, and it contains a list of people divided into categories, like effective persons, non-status effective persons, then non-effective persons, and it contains a number of Ukrainian figures, including journalists, editors, researchers, historians, politicians, including this Albu, Sergei Albu from Boryba that I mentioned earlier. And basically, what happened is that this political network got a list each week and got a list of topics that they should promote. And basically, it was like, for instance, I love this one, with MH17. So this letter was about the time that MH17 was downed. And basically, one of the thematic lines was to compare this downing with the killing of Franz Ferdinand in Austro-Hungary. That was Ukrainian provocation to start of World War III. And one Russian official planted this conspiracy into CNN, former Kremlin advisor Alexander Nekrasov. And then journalist Viktor Rudnev basically wrote the same thing in Korrespondent.net.
Wow.
So basically, it's like it was a list of the talking points, the Kremlin talking points that the political network was to disseminate in the ways that it was possible for them.
How big is the network in Ukraine?
the effectiveness of the Kremlin's propaganda machine and soft power machine, it relies on people on the ground, Ukrainians that are willing, basically, to collaborate. I don't know if they collaborate for ideological reasons or is it for money, but in any case, they are able to pinpoint the weak points in the public opinion, in the socio-economical situation, and say which of these points the Kremlin could manipulate to incite unrest. And this is basically, I mean, we've seen it with the Glazyev tapes. So let's recall Glazyev tapes. Also, advisor of Putin. In these tapes, basically, we've seen how the Kremlin masterminded separatism in Odessa and in Crimea. The scheme was to use media and use coordinated protests on the ground, coordinators on the ground to ramp up public protests. And so we see this picture of people rallying for Putin, bring in your troops, and that's when Russia can intervene. And it has like a pretext. So basically, that was the scheme that the Kremlin was trying to implement in Novorossiya, and the same is here. It acts through agents on the ground to influence public opinion, influence the media, and stimulate unrest, and basically bring down Ukraine with its own hands.
The Moscow Times covered it. The American Interest and I think The Guardian started to cover the Surkov leaks. They quoted the digital forensic lab this way, the Moscow Times did. The Surkov leaks, as they have been called on Twitter since their release, show us a picture of the conflict in eastern Ukraine that we have long suspected. The Kremlin had a guiding hand in orchestrating and funding the supposedly local and independent governments, referring to the DNR and LNR. Now, Ukrainian media outlets are in the hands of a few oligarchs. Do you think the editors, producers, journalists, do they have the willpower to break through that filter, that oligarchic filter, and present fact-based reporting and real analysis that you've been talking about today?
Well, if we're talking about the Surkov leaks, I have a feeling that Ukrainian outlets were very suspicious of them because of the plan Shatun that was promoted by the SBU and Hirashenko. And it was not included in the dump, so investigative journalists have not been able to verify the origins of this leak. So basically, this Shatun plan, it cast a shadow on the whole leak for the Ukrainian scene, at least. That was my impression. But there were journalists that did analysis, Radia Svoboda and Gardon. They did do analysis.
On the Shatun story.
On the Shatun also, but mostly on the leak itself. So Shatun is just a scan that was published by Cyber Junta separately, and it's impossible to verify its origins.
Right. Now, Cyber Junta was the group that actually got the Surkov leaks.
Yes. Cyber Junta is part of the Cyber Alliance. Cyber Alliance, it's a coalition of Ukrainian hackers fighting the info war only in cyberspace.
So we have to back up a little bit. The Shatun story is something that came out today on the Solidarity Facebook page, that it was apparently Yulia Tymoshenko's Batkivshchina party referenced it, and that it was part of the National Front, but the Solidarity people are saying that it's a fake.
We cannot say anything yet because we did not see it in the dump. I mean, when we can access a document in the dump and see the digital header of the email and see who it came from, et cetera, that would give us more reason to say that, like, what is this all about?
So there essentially is nothing that substantially defines what the Shatun is.
I cannot comment on it because I have not seen the proof.
Do you think that 3 years after the Euromaidan, that the attitude towards Russian efforts to destabilize Ukraine have become patently obvious to your average Ukrainian, that they can see this almost like a train on the prairies, mm-hmm. They can see it a mile away. Is that a sign that maybe Ukrainian society is more advanced and that alternative media outlets like Euromaidan Press, Stop Fake, the newly launched Ukrainian Media Network and Hromadske Radio are more trusted sources of information?
Well, Well, first, I would like to comment on Ukrainians sort of feeling the landscape that Russia is trying to influence their country and et cetera. This is actually, I think it's sort of like a defense mechanism that Ukrainians have grown over these last years. And actually, it's this propensity for defending themselves against Russian narratives. It's noted in Surkov leaks as one of the problems impeding the development of these independent media outlets and pro-Russian messages, et cetera, et cetera. It's like Ukrainians don't buy this. And I think that's pretty good. And maybe it's natural in a time of de facto war. Regarding independent media outlets, of course, the number of independent media outlets that emerged after Euromaidan, it's a positive sign. I hope that they will grow and gain audience and stimulate discussions in Ukrainian society.
Alia Shandra, Euromaidan Press, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
In a move to bring Ukraine in line with European regulations on copyright and put the kibosh on piracy, Ukraine's most popular websites where Ukrainians can watch films and TV series for free, X.ua and FS.to, were permanently banned this week by the cyber unit of the National Police for sharing pirated content. However, the online cinema source FS.to claims that it will become available in about 2 weeks, since Ukrainian cyber police can only delete content from Ukrainian servers, and FS.to claims to have some content stored on servers not located in Ukraine, according to Union. Ukrainian Andriy Holodov launched a startup called eCozy that allows you to control heating from your smartphone and save up to 30% of the heating bill by not heating empty rooms. The product was launched in Germany, where Andriy Holodov lives, and has proven to help save about 500 euros per season. It's not the first time Ukrainians introduced high-quality startups. Remember that earlier this year, a Ukrainian team won the NASA Space App Challenge. And, by the way, on December 15th, Google's office in London will be hosting a Ukraine-UK IT and tech startup roadshow. The tickets are free and available on Eventbrite for anyone interested in some of the new developments trending in Ukraine's IT community. Hromadske.ua reported that American actor Johnny Depp, famous for Edward Scissorhands and Dead Man, joined an international campaign to support freedom for Ukrainian filmmaker Oleg Sentsov. The Voice Project started a campaign called Imprisoned for Art, and they are raising awareness about artists who are now prisoners of conscience. They aim to familiarize the public with stories of several artists who are behind bars in several different countries. A lot of well-known artists like Peter Gabriel, Alex Ebert, Anna Tijoux joined the effort. Nadia Tolokonnikova, member of Pussy Riot, also joined the effort after having spent a year and a half in a Russian penal colony for an anti-Putin performance. Johnny Depp posed for a mugshot with the particulars of Oleg Sentsov's sentence. Sentsov was sentenced to 20 years of hard labor by a kangaroo court and is serving time in the Yakutsk region of Russia. On the Voice Project page, you can send an email to Russian Ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin, and urge him to unconditionally release the artist. We'll include a link to the site on our page. Kazimir Malevich was born in Kyiv in 1878. He became one of the most important artists of the 20th century and is often called the father of suprematism. Last Friday, on November 11th, a major exhibit of Malevich's works opened in Kyiv. It's on the second floor art center, which is inside the Ukrainian presidential administration. The exhibit is called Malevich, Beyond the Canvas. His most famous paintings are exhibited in 3D, an innovative way to show Malevich's work. The exhibit is both about art and politics. While Malevich is internationally known, many describe him as a Russian or even a Polish artist. He was born to a Polish family that had settled in Kyiv, which was then part of the Russian Empire. Later he moved to Kursk, then on to Moscow. In 1914, he exhibited his works in Paris's Salon des Independents along with other Ukrainian artists like Alexander Arkhipenko, Sonia Delaunay, Alexander Erkster, Vadim Miller, and others, who are also sometimes called Russians. According to the press release on President Poroshenko's website, the aim of the exhibit is to discover the special genome of suprematism, which will help understand the nature of avant-garde paintings, and also to quote-unquote return Malevich to Ukraine. We'll post a link to the exhibit on our site. A documentary film festival is starting in Mariupol this week and will continue through December the 7th. A total of 24 films will be shown during this non-commercial and non-political festival. It's co-organized by the Priazovia Human Rights Group and the club Maybutnya, which means future, and is being held in the Mariupol Palace of Culture. Admission is free. More information will be available on our website. This week's song is by a group called the Vyo, and it's filled with irony. You'll recognize the tune right away, but have a Ukrainian friend translate the lyrics for you because it's about feeling like a foreigner in your own country. Enjoy. Next week will mark 3 years since the Euromaidan protest broke out on November 21st, 2013. Tensions in Kyiv seem to be on the rise again. We'll be following these and other developments and bringing them to you, hopefully with a little bit of harmony. I'm Marco Suprin in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.